So we're continuing this exploration of the paramis, the 10 perfections. So we've gone through generosity, through sila or ethics, through renunciation, and now we come to wisdom. So continuing this, how they, each of them kind of feed upon each other, help support each other. Now, how will we define wisdom? You know, we could define wisdom by, okay, understanding the three characteristics. You know, maybe there's a intellectual sense of it, or even a direct seeing of it as it's arising in our moment's experience. Maybe you could define it by understanding the four noble truths or the eightfold path or the dependent origination. There's so many different ways we can explore and define wisdom. Now, I was sitting here in the hall on Friday when Ajahn Jayasara defined wisdom in an interesting way. He defined it as non-harm, that you aren't causing harm toward yourself or toward others. I thought that was a really interesting way to define it. Not some kind of dharmic concept or even deep states of insight. It's this sense of non-harm coming from our lives based in non-harm, kind of losing that capacity or the willingness to cause harm to other beings. It's such an interesting measure of our of wisdom. You know, what is our relationship to it? Because our actions are really a proof of who we actually are, that sense of integration. Because we can have, you know, again, practice very deeply on retreats or practice in our daily sits. But if it doesn't start to change how we actually show up in our world, in our lives, it perhaps is not as strong as it could be. There's a lack of integration. Our wisdom isn't growing as deeply as it can. And we can kind of talk a good talk like, okay, I know all this stuff. But when we actually act, how do we actually act in our relationships? How do we actually act in our work, in our families, raising our children, caring for our elders? How do we work with all of that? It's really a test of our practice. It's kind of a manifestation of our wisdom. And this is an interesting way that our practice starts to transform us, just almost behind the scenes without us even realizing it. So I'm teaching an intro class, as I do throughout the year at a few different times. And I'd love to see how people just starting the practice often see this transformation in a highlighted form. When you've been practicing for a while, you kind of sometimes take it for granted or you forget how much it has changed you. But people sometimes just raise their hand and say that, okay, I notice I'm supervising these people, and they suddenly, I'm no longer being so judgmental and being more patient, or working with being with your family, with your children, a capacity to be present. Patterns start to just slough off and fall away. Not from a conscious choice, like I'm going to get rid of this pattern, but they just somehow start to fall away. And that's the power of the mindfulness practice, the insight practice, that we're learning how to make contact with this present moment, to actually perceive how things actually are. And that actual perception starts to change the way we are in the world. We start to see cause and effect. We start to see patterns that create more and more suffering and the release of that suffering. So it's almost a mysterious way how the practice starts to change us, starts to have this wisdom growing in the background. Learning to perceive more and more clearly. I remember Sharon Salzberg, one of the senior women in this tradition, she once said, try not to judge your practice by how it feels, okay, but more by how it shows up in your life. How it shows up in your relationships, in your work, and how you do your chores. That's where you start to see those transformations. Because often how it feels, sometimes it feels really blissful and peaceful, and sometimes it feels a little less than that. You know, those of you who went down to Olympia to listen to Abdon Tupten over the weekend, at one point he was just saying that, you know, sometimes meditation just has these beautiful, peaceful states. And sometimes it's a little bit more like sticking your head in a trash can. And you're going to see all of the stuff coming off, all the content, all the unresolved things, the anger, the fear, all this stuff starts to turn, right? It's like, okay, this isn't working. I'm feeling all this stuff. We don't realize it actually is working. It's actually starting to move through us. It's starting to purify from us. So our actions really are a litmus test for how we show up in the world. So I really appreciate that Ajahn defined it that way, defining wisdom not as, you know, what we know or our concepts or our philosophy, even our insights. Because if those insights just stay in this kind of isolated part of our lives, they have very limited value. But when they start to come into the fabric of our life, to the actual way that we show up, the way we our perceptions change, then that's a manifestation of wisdom. You know, when I work with students, when I are helping them with their practices, I like to see, okay, how much is this integrating into their life? How much is it trying to transform their life? Because if we keep it just kind of an isolated part, okay, I just go and practice, then I check that off my box, my to-do list, it doesn't have as much potential as it really does. This is really embedded in the Buddhist teachings. The Eightfold Noble Path isn't just meditation. That's just 1/8 of it, actually, or maybe 2/8 of it. We have concentration, wise mindfulness. There's our intention behind our actions, our wisdom that flows from that. And the major part of it is our actions in our life, how we act with our bodies, how we speak, how we make a livelihood. So this integration of non-harm and ethics really represent our wisdom. That's how we see where our wisdom shows up. So tonight I'd like to explore wisdom from that lens, from that viewpoint of how it changes the way, very way we act in the world. And also in three ways. So one is how we act. And a more subtle aspect of that is actually how we perceive. How we actually start to see the world from a different perspective. I think that's one of the ways I like to define insight, is that when we have a change of view, a change of perspective, we start to reorder life in a way that actually is more aligned with how it actually is. We start to see how we've created suffering. So this is the change of perception. And then finally, there's a sense of identification. You know, where is that locus of who we take ourselves to be? How fully is that believed in? How fully is that acted from? Or is it starting to thin? Is it starting to soften? Is it becoming less and less, you know, powerful and pervasive? And each of these is really kind of more and more subtle aspects of it. Our actions show up. We can see those pretty obviously. And then underneath what's driving those actions is often our perception. We perceive the world in a certain way. We perceive ourselves in a certain way. And then our actions flow from that. If we misperceive it, our actions are going to be a little bit off, or quite a bit off. And then that very sense of who we take ourselves to be profoundly shapes the way we perceive the world, the way we interpret the world, we interpret the sense data. I mean, there's on this evening we have around 80 people here. Each one of us is perceiving this moment a little bit differently. Even though, you know, we can watch the Zoom recording and say, okay, this is what's happening. Yet each one of us is interpreting it through our history. We can't help but do that. Dharma practice, meditation practice, is a process of trying to make that more and more conscious, to see what we've added on to the present moment. Added on to this, so we can actually start to see it without being so shaped, so really distorted or influenced by our history, by our past, by our conditioning. So let's look at these three, our actions, our perceptions, and that sense of self, and how they all can be a manifestation of our wisdom. Or our ignorance. So our actions. So we're exploring this topic of wisdom in the context of the paramis. Okay, so these 10 perfections, which are said to be what we really cultivate and work with and deepen into. And that's part of the ground that allows us to fully awaken. And it's said that the Buddha worked with these over his past lives till the point they became to such a level of development and integration that he was able to then take that next and last step. You know, whether or not you believe in lives and reincarnation and all that, it's a very helpful lens to look at, to open to, kind of look at each of these aspects. I often appreciate the Buddhist teachings because they're so comprehensive. It actually helps you look at parts you wouldn't normally look at. Do I look at this generosity? Do I look at my ethics? Do I look at renunciation? And so the paramis, each one of them support each other. They're kind of part of almost a hologram that they're so interlinked. So the previous three paramis of generosity, of ethics, of renunciation come together, they interrelate, they work together, and they also help cultivate this arising of wisdom. So really working with those, really nurturing wisdom to arise. So they start to lay the foundation, they lay this groundwork. Now these first three, it's interesting that we think about wisdom. Let's say we pluck in three characteristics as a definition of wisdom, okay? That there's dukkha, that there's suffering, there's an unsubstantiality of experience. Let's say we look at anicca, impermanence, the sense that things are always arising and passing away, and how we get confused about that. We take things as being solid when they actually are in a state of flux, arising or fading. And then anatta, non-self. We take away there's a solid sense of self that's having all these experiences. And yet when we look closely, we see that's actually an illusion. Now these can be a little abstract. They don't have to be abstract. The practice is designed to let us see those in a very real, immediate, direct way. In a way that's unshakable when we see it actually in this moment's experience. This moment's arising. But it can be a little bit abstract, you know, especially until we, you know, like, am I really acting from a place of non-self or am I doing from self? Am I relating to permanence or impermanence? Am I understanding dukkha? But those three of paramis of generosity, of sila or ethics, and renunciation, they're much more concrete. We can actually see that. We can actually observe that action. Actually see how we're acting in this moment. Are we acting in a generous way? Are we acting in a way that's more contracted of heart? Are we acting in a way that's aligned with ethics, renunciation? And in those actions, as we've been exploring, you can also start to see the attitude that's behind those actions, right? So actions don't just show up of generosity in a vacuum. There's an attitude that's behind that, or an attitude of non-generosity or greed. How, what's the attitude behind that? So it's kind of a nice feedback loop. We can see, am I acting generous in this moment? If I am, I can open to that. If I feel like there's not that tendency to want to be generous, I can actually use that as an opportunity to investigate, to turn toward, to explore. Now the paramis, like this first one, generosity, looking at how it really helps support wisdom arising. Looking at the lens kind of bringing these two lists, the three characteristics and these paramis together, the lens of suffering versus happiness. You know, not the happiness that's based on conditions, on situations, but the happiness that's kind of transcending those conditions. The happiness that's beyond conditions. You know, that lens, which actions lead of generosity lead more to happiness, which lead more to suffering? What's the joy of giving? Of receiving, the joy of connecting, And there's a sense of deep joy that comes from that, as we explored in February. You know, as I can really give something, and I give it without the strings attached, without any sense of obligation from the receiver, and a sense of releasing, connecting with the quality of that we're all in this together, connecting with the quality of abundance, of sharing our own good fortune, whether it's of time, of money, of energy. There's that sharing. And in that receiving of that, there's this beautifulness of connection, that beautiful quality of interrelationship that's affirmed by that. Well, the opposite of that, when we're caught in being defended, there's a sense of scarcity, a sense of lack, a sense of having to protect ourselves, to kind of keep things just for us. And there's a pain in that. Practice lets us see that pain, lets us see the joy more and more clearly. I think that's why meditation starts to change things for us, because we start to see that in a more and more clear way. We start to actually perceive what is arising, what's here. Because usually we're a little bit confused, there's a level of delusion, clouds the way we perceive, the way we actually are able to interpret how things actually are. We start to kind of clear that dust from our eyes. The lens of impermanence in relationship to generosity. We start to learn to hold things more lightly. That, okay, this thing is so precious to me, realizing that at some point it will be dust or start to fall apart. There's a story about a Zen master who would receive like a beautiful teacup and already imagine it shattered or broken. So there's that sense of appreciating its beauty, but also realizing that once it's come into form, once it's been created into this beautiful teacup, eventually it will no longer be a teacup. Eventually it will be broken and shattered. And we start to relate to life a little bit more lightly. It's not so much trying to push life away or not feel, but just realizing that things are fleeting. We just last month passed the beautiful season of cherry blossoms. Now this often symbolizes this impermanence, the beauty of them arising, the blossoms arising, the fragrance, but yet we know that they only last for a short period. Deeply knowing that all conditioned things are impermanent. Like the famous chant, that all conditioned things are impermanent, with the nature to arise and pass away. One who abides in this truth will live with happiness. One who abides in this truth will live in happiness. Okay, this is an expression of wisdom. This shows up how we relate to life, how we actually act. Do I act in trying to hold things beyond their natural lifespan? Do I try to grip to that? Or is there more of a grace as we allow things to change, to pass away? Are we able to meet things arising, the new birth of this moment, the birth of this experience? And generosity then becomes more natural, the sharing, the receiving, the giving, the coming and going is part of this natural play of life. In the lens of anatta, of non-self. Generosity is such a helpful way to kind of explore anatta, non-self, because I think we can all relate to that when we feel that we don't want to be generous, we don't feel like being generous. The sense of self feels really intact. I'm trying to protect this limited resource of whatever it might be. You know, that sense of there's not enough for me, there's something lacking in myself. There's a sense of deep separation. That gulf that divides us is more and more clear. Me versus you. While generosity, that starts to soften. There's a sense of interconnection. And for me, there's often this kind of edge. I feel that little bit of contraction, and then as a release into generosity, there's also a small way of releasing that sense of self. Is it releasing that contraction, that reaffirming that isolation? Greed affirms that solidification of self, while generosity affirms that softening of self. It affirms this reality of interconnection, interrelationship. If you can start to see how this one parami of generosity, we can look at it from so many different ways, but they all starts to work to allow wisdom to grow. It's not growing from a intellectual standpoint, it's growing from our very way of seeing it show up. How can I really get into the idea of generosity? Can I really work with that and open to it, practice it? This allows wisdom to start to grow. We can do the same process with sila, with ethics, you know, how we act in a place of non-harm. And these lines between generosity and ethics, they start to blur at some level, especially as our wisdom starts to grow. It's almost like instead of us going through our normal mind and sense of separation, it's like our heart is starting to come forth. Our heart is starting to lead our actions. We start to relate to people not from separation, but from connection, from care. So non-harm and ethics starts to become an expression of generosity, a generosity of spirit, that you start to really care for other people's well-being. Sometimes it takes the shape of offering. Sometimes it takes the shape of receiving. And sometimes it takes the shape of just, I don't want any harm to come to you. I want you to feel a sense of safety and protection in this life. So our hearts start to shape and direct our actions. They start to shape the way we are. So generosity is one aspect. Non-harm is the other. Caring about the impact of our actions. This is where the meditation loops back in. We start to perceive this more and more clearly. There's this thing, I've shared this story a number of times, but it comes to mind around just simple, slight ways of harm that we do in relationships. And this pattern I had when my family, my wife and daughter and I were going to go on a vacation, and just feeling, to be honest, kind of uptight about leaving on time and trying to get everything organized and being a little cranky, a little harsh in my speech. And I knew I wanted to let go of that, but I couldn't. It just kept coming again and again. And then one day I asked them, tell me what it's like. What's your experience of me like when I'm in those states? And I really listened in an undefended way, in an unguarded way. Right? So again, wisdom and compassion coming through. As I really heard the impact of it, I was able to let go of that pattern in a much more deep way. Because I touched it, I actually connected with it. Sometimes I think that so much of our suffering, we don't connect with the suffering that's there. There's pleasure with it, there's personal gain, there's ways it reinforces us. But like if I touched a hot stone and it burnt my hand, and I really felt that burn, I wouldn't pick that stone up again. Right? But so often we don't realize that we're burning ourselves. Meditation allows us to see that, to actually perceive that with more and more clarity. And so with this, just with the process we went through with generosity, ethics, we can see the same way the characteristics, the three characteristics, also at work. We understand dukkha. We understand how can we open to it, perceive it. Opening to it is the first foundation, the first noble truth, I should say. Okay, there is dukkha. Actually perceiving there is dukkha. And such wisdom, and okay, first we have to perceive that there's dukkha here before we can start to understand the cause of it, before we can understand the release of that. We start to sense more and more clearly where our actions flow from. Are they acting in a way that's creating more suffering, creating more hardship, or releasing a protection of safety, of ease with the people around us? We start to sense the harm that's caused. We start to own up to that. We're willing to actually listen, get the feedback of life. Because we're human. We're going to cause harm with each other. We can learn how to listen to that and learn how to grow. Start to release the unnecessary harm. We start to understand impermanence in relationship to Sila. That our reactions, our defensiveness, our emotions. I think one person, I don't know if it was a Dharma teacher, it was probably more of a therapist, said that our emotions are not an emergency. And we can feel the intensity of it. But that also is impermanent. Actually tune into it. That's this point in the meditation intro class, we just introduced how to work with emotions, how to turn toward it as a body sensation. We start to turn toward it as a body sensation and release the storyline of it. We can feel the changing experience. We can feel the tightness and the contraction. But it's not as static as we used to think it was. If we stay in the story, just feel like I'm just angry, angry, angry. But actually release the story and go into the sensations of it, I realize this is actually this arising and passing away. There's this throbbing, there's this contraction, this opening. And in that, I hold it a little bit more lightly. I hold it not as a solid thing, but actually as a process moving through me. And of course, anatta, the play between form and formless. With ethics, it's such an interesting thing to really bring a mature view into it. Because sometimes we can think, okay, everything's empty. It doesn't really matter what I do. That's really a distortion of this understanding, a distortion of the teachings. Because it does matter. Our actions do matter. So we hold both this relationship of emptiness, inner and outer emptiness, and yet we also care deeply for the individual, for the uniqueness, and the, you know, what helps someone feel safe. How can our own actions be held with integrity? And then the last prayer made from last month, renunciation. Renunciation, especially when we first did this deeper work around generosity, around ethics, starts to become just what the heart wants to do. The heart just naturally releases things which are of greed, releasing things which are of hatred. Because we're starting to more and more clearly perceive what leads to suffering, what leads to freedom. Because both generosity and ethics have an element of renunciation in them. There's a releasing our greed, releasing our hatred, releasing the isolation, the contraction, releasing all our patterns, our forgetfulness. So this is all around this aspect of actions, how we actually act in the world, how we show up. And so pay attention. Pay attention to life's feedback, especially those who are close to you, who are willing to share that. Pay attention to strangers. Sometimes we just kind of discount people's feelings or their needs because they're not just a kind of nameless service person. To actually meet them with a quality of compassion, actually look, put yourself in their own, you into their own shoes. How would you act? How would you want to be treated? Actions depend upon our perception. Okay, so wisdom changes the very way we perceive things. And our perception changes the way we act. Right? If we misperceive something, we act in a different way. It's like that classic example, walking in the dusk, see a coil of rope in the distance. You think, okay, that's a coil of rope, but then your perception changes and you think it's a snake. Okay, so the snake then, that you start to feel afraid, you're worried it's going to bite you. And if it bites you, maybe you won't be able to get help in time. Maybe you'll lose your leg. And if you lose your leg, you won't be able to work. If you can't work, you lose your job. Your spouse will leave you. It's just this whole cascade of thought action. Right? Remember, thought is considered a form of action. We've created this whole story based on a misperception. So insight practice is learning how to see life more clearly. It starts to change some of these underlying assumptions. Because usually we see through our history, through our conditioning. There is a phrase that you see in the suttas about this idea of this dust in our eyes. They were seeing through this layer of dust of distortion. They were not seeing things how they actually are. This little fragment of a poem by Samuel Green, when he says, everything we see carries the burden of what we know until we let it be itself again. And just that little phrase there carries so much Dharma wisdom. Everything we see carries the burden of what we know until we let it be itself again. You could practice with that for years, that everything you see, you're putting a burden on it of what you know. Okay, I know who that person is. I know their history. Or I don't know them and I'm projecting on them with all my biases and prejudices, how I perceive myself. Even something, it's like a tree. I can look at a tree and see, okay, this is what I think the tree is. I know it's a Douglas fir, and this is its how it grows, and this is what you can use the wood for, and da-da-da, all those things. Or I can let all those go. I can let the tree be itself again. I can let it actually reveal itself. I can let that person be themselves again. And so this is, I think, one of the deepest things, I don't want to say the deepest, but it's a deep aspect of Dharma practice that starts to let us see things how they actually are. I was listening to John Hyatt, his song, A Thing Called Love, and there's a line that stood out in relationship to this, that whether your sunglasses are off or on, you only see the world you make. You only see the world that you make. So we see the world that we've made through our ideas, our perceptions. And it's a little bit sobering when we think about that, because each one of us here, again, is seeing a world in a particular way. You know, we can see our commonality. We can also see our diversity, you know, our upbringing, our culture, our prejudice. All these things shape the way we see the world. So on a very fundamental level, our perception, we can almost come down to one basic thing. We see the world as two or as one. We see unity or we see separation. So learning to see differently, it is a practice. It is something that we learn to do again and again. Even very simply, just when you meditate, when you first start to meditate, sometimes just notice your body and just notice, okay, this is my body. And all the baggage, all the things you've added onto this body, your beliefs, your history, parts you like, parts you don't like, you can feel how it defines you and the body itself. But when you close your eyes and you go into the actual sensations of this body, what happens to that idea? What happens to the concept? It starts to soften, it starts to dissolve. And in its place, there's this aliveness, this richness, this arising and passing away of sensations. And sometimes that's a little disconcerting because, like, where did my body go? If I'm not thinking about my body and I go to the direct experience of it, it's not there in the same way. Take that little example and extrapolate it to all the mental phenomena, all the ways you hold the world in a certain way. Take this simple example. Look at it in terms of like racism, for example. Look at it in any kind of ism that we do. We project on another person, but that's what we're adding to the present, to that person's experience, to the way we're perceiving it. Our actions flow from that. When our actions, we start to perceive in a more clear way, wisdom naturally arises from that. We start to act from a wise place. And then finally, underlying all this, so there's actions, there's our perceptions that lead to those actions, and then a more subtle perception really is that sense of self, the sense of me, the sense of who I take myself to be. So there's different levels of that. There's the psychological levels, you know, there's the healthy sense of self and the dysfunction of sense of self that we're learning to navigate. You know, how can I have more self-love, self-appreciation? How can I work with my patterns? This is all helpful and necessary work. And a deeper level of the self is just that framework of isolation, of separation, of basic assumption that loads up so quickly. Like we turn on our computer, operating system loads up that allows us to navigate the computer system. That system that loads up is that sense of me and you, two things, separate, isolated. And this is really a deep perception or misperception. And from that misperception, then everything else flows from that. So our practice starts to teach us that. Sometimes it does it kind of in a sneaky way. Like as I mentioned with meditation, you're just sitting, minding your own business, trying to feel your breath, and your body just seems to lose its normal definition. Sometimes you notice those patterns arise. Okay, it's almost an invitation, like the loading up of the pattern, the setup. And you realize, I don't really feel like doing that pattern anymore. I don't feel like being that irritated dad/husband. Something's falling away. So we start to notice, how am I reinforcing that sense of self? How am I acting from that in an unconscious way? Or how am I acting in a way that's flowing not from the sense of self? Right? Generosity at its deepest form, it really affirms that. It affirms that release of separation. Ethics, it's like, if I'm unethical to you, I'm really being unethical to myself. I'm causing harm to you is really the same as causing harm to myself. The Indian non-dual teacher, Nirsagadatta, said that when I look inside and see that I am nothing, that is wisdom. When I look outside and see that I am everything, that is love. And between these two, my life flows. So between these two, my life flows. Yeah, so there's this understanding that I look inside, I can't find that sense of self. And when I look outside, I can feel the interconnection that I am everything. And the life flows between those. Right? So then wisdom and our actions just flow. You know, our actions become a manifestation of our understanding. I appreciate that Ajahn Jayasaro said that wisdom is a manifestation, is really of non-harm, because that we can see how deep that goes and how it really is. We can fool ourselves. We can think, okay, I really have this meditation down. I'm such a spiritual person. And then I get around that difficult person, I get around my in-laws, I get someone honking at me. Okay, what arises? What arises in that? And the purpose of this talk is not to give yourself another thing to feel inadequate around. Okay, I'm just not wise enough. But use it more as a chance to turn toward. Okay, let me look at this as an invitation to learn something about myself. To learn how my heart contracts, to learn how that sense of impermanence is not seen, how that sense of self is reaffirmed. In that way, wisdom, that attitude of learning, of exploration, of really an innocent curiosity, then wisdom just is going to grow in all of us. All right, thank you for your kind attention. If you could just sit quietly for a couple moments. Okay, I don't have any homework for you, but just, you know, play with this idea of wisdom as we'll be exploring. Next week we'll have Carrie Peterson will be teaching, And then she'll be actually do 2 weeks in a row, and then we'll have the last week will be the remembrance evening. We just remember those who have passed and talk about how to work with that. But let's see if you have any questions or sharing or things you'd like to explore around this topic of wisdom or anything else in the Dharma is fine. So in person, you can just raise your hand and we can have you grab the mic so they can hear you online. And those online, you can just raise your virtual hand. Yes, Kaba, do you mind coming on up?
I really like the quote that you shared about it doesn't feel good. Even when wisdom is arising, it doesn't mean, oh, I just feel so wise and I'm transcending it. And my example, what came to me was I have made a plan to do something with a good friend. It's something I wanted to do for a long time. She's excited. Last week she said, I don't think I can go. And it's September. It's paid for. It's full. I don't want to go alone. And it wasn't like inside I went, oh, I have wisdom about this. I totally understand. I was disappointed. I was mad. Her reasons were completely legitimate. It had to do with her husband and medical and all those things. And I did find that space where I could say, I'm so disappointed. And she said, me too. And yet even then, you know, I kept having those irrational thoughts of, you know, she should have known. And just watching that, I appreciate what you said, Tim, because I'm realizing, like, that's wisdom arising. Mm-hmm. That's noticing the discomfort, noticing, you know, those fantasies, like, I thought a future was guaranteed, but anything. And it's rocky, and it's fascinating. So, yeah, thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah, that sense of expectation, that sense of projective permanence. Okay, this plan's always going to be this way. We're going to have this experience. And it's, so part of it is the feedback of life saying, okay, you know, however you think it's going to be different than that. Sometimes radically different. Because life is full of disappointments, right? It's full of, you know, bruises and hurts and trauma and all these things arise. So how do we meet that? How are we open to it? And, you know, we also have to watch as practitioners, that sometimes we get into this idea that, oh, if I was more spiritual, I wouldn't be feeling this. Like, if I really had my stuff together, I would not be feeling it. I'd be like, oh, okay, that's just life. That's just impermanence. No problem. So I think we also have to really notice our own inner experience, you know, and really acknowledge it. I think that's first noble truth. Okay, where does the dukkha actually make contact to really acknowledge that this is here? You know, in a very human way. You know, I think it's, one teacher described it, it's one of the most important things to do as a human being is to be transcend being human. The other equally important thing is to be fully human, right? So we have to be fully human. So just notice if we're misusing our practice to kind of distort or to say, I shouldn't be this way. If I was a different way, if I was more together, my prayer was more wise. Now, wisdom is one of those things that have these shadows in it, right? The shadow of I'm going to fake it. I'm going to pretend I'm wiser than I really am. But really, the true wisdom is just as you did. You owned it. You connected with it. There's all the interpersonal dynamics of how do you navigate relationships and say, I'm disappointed, and, you know, being honest, that's part of that manifestation of wisdom. All right, thank you, Kappa. All right, anyone else like to ask or share anything? All right, Austin.
Tim, I just wanted to say that that was one of the most delightful talks And I'm really grateful. And maybe it's because I'm more relaxed today. As you can see, I'm at home and relaxed. And so I received the teachings differently, but I did want to name that. And what really touched me was just, you know, just talking about all the different ways wisdom shows up in our lives. And one thing that I've been sitting with a lot and would love to hear your thought about this is, as my practice deepens, wisdom shows up in very, very subtle ways. Like the wisdom to know when there's a difficult situation arising, to be with that situation, because sometimes there's the sublime even in the difficult. And quick example was on an airplane recently, sitting next to a person who had outward expressions of dementia on the flight, and all of the instincts that everybody else who was, you know, whispering with one another and trying to stay away from the person, they came up in me too. But I had this like subtle wisdom in the Dharma just to tell me, this is why we practice, be here. And seeing a part of this person towards the end of the flight, he had a lot of outward expressions, like I was saying, that you know, that were difficult. But at the end of the flight, as we were landing, he turned to me and thanked me. A part of him knew that I was meeting him with kindness. And it wasn't me trying to be kind. It was me. It was this subtle wisdom of being with what's difficult, and that there's something in the Dharma I've learned with, including in meditation, that the breakthroughs are often right there in the midst of the difficulty. So anyway, I wanted to share that, but most importantly, just to thank you, Tim, for such a beautiful and inspiring talk.
Thank you, Austin, for sharing that. That's nice to hear. And I think the maturity, as our practice matures, we do start to see that those difficulties, those rubs, those difficult situations are actually, that's a time that really need to show up. That's actually a time just to explore our practice, to explore those edges. You know, over this day long that Abdon Tupten did down in Olympia, he was talking about the 10,000 joys and 10,000 sorrows of this human realm, basically. And the joys is like we're so drawn to that. Okay, let's go into these joys. Let's use those as a gateways into opening. But he was saying those sorrows are actually a really important gateway. Those are the ones that, you know, how can we see through that? And just like how you did, you can see all the reaction that comes up around that. And yet you still connected with him as a human being. You connected in that very direct way. And there's that choice point. All the people were kind of pulling away and going away from him. There's kind of this often an unconscious choice to reaffirm that separation, the otherness. Okay, that's someone who has dementia, and I don't want to be near them, and all their own fear around that and that experience. And yet you're able to connect. And so you reaffirm interconnection. You affirmed the humanness. And that's such a, you know, those little stories, those little experiences do, I think it's so important for us to practice in those small ways, and, you know, more and more continuously, because those small ways, there's constant opportunities that show up. And what happens is our wisdom, our practice gets to a certain point that we start to notice those. We start to notice when those arise. You know, at first it's almost like any kind of sport or activity, when you first learn it, you're kind of doing these huge motions, right? But, you know, like maybe skiing. Like, I'm not a downhill skier, but I imagine when you first start to ski, you're kind of plowing one way and you're plowing the other way. But you look at an expert, they're just doing these little weight shifts and they're just smoothly going down the slopes. And same thing with our practice. We just see that little bit of a shift. Oh, separation, you start to notice it right when that starts to load up, when that perception loads up, and you have the opportunity to make a different choice. And mindfulness gives us that gift. So thank you for sharing that, Austin. All right, what else is out there? Any questions? Or I always appreciate that time, because it allows us to, you know, really make the practice our own, to really articulate our own experience. And It's my preferred way of teaching, actually, is through questions. No pressure, though. I know we're going to be a crowd of introverts. Do you mind coming up so I can hear you online?
Hi. Yeah, my name is Pragna, which means intuitive wisdom.
Oh, so. Beautiful. You should have given the talk.
So first, this is your whole explanation was completely different than what I understood, so I really appreciate it. There are a couple things you said that really kind of rang the bells for me, so I just wanted to share an experience that I had recently. So one thing you said, like the contraction in your body, and I thought that was a really, that's a really good gauge. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is to what, like, to be aware of your story, you know, that you're projecting, your worldview. Or whatever. So I was in a restaurant, and I asked the waiter, are there any specials? And he said, no. And so then we ordered. But the people next to us were these young, beautiful women, and they had something that wasn't on the menu. So immediately when their dish came, I contracted. I didn't notice I contracted. I went into my story. It's ageism, you know. It's ageism, racism, whatever. And then I noticed my body was contracting. So I told my friend, you know, I have to watch my thoughts. Like, maybe he is. Ageist, or maybe he's just having a bad day. And then at the end of the meal, she was looking at him, and my friend, and she said, look, he's beat. He's at the end of his shift. And I realized I'd made up this whole story in my head, and he was just trying to get through his day. He didn't want to, you know, whether there were specials or not, I don't know. But suddenly, my heart opened a little for him. I'm like, okay, I didn't open to compassion of how he's doing either. So anyway, it was like you hit on a, so it was the beginning of wisdom, I guess, for me in that moment. But,
Well, the wisdom was the willingness to not just stay in your story, or to actually keep opening to it, to feel it, articulating to your friend, you know, and you know, maybe it was true, maybe it was ageism or racism, who knows, but you were able to open to that, and then, but through opening to it, you know, your wisdom would allow you to open in a way that wasn't, because sometimes we open to a way that actually makes it stronger, but you're opening to a way that actually started to let it soften. You start to feel, oh, there's, maybe this guy's just worn out. You know, he's just tired. So there's that compassion. So you can see it's like the wisdom is because life is going to give us those things, you know. And how do we meet them? How do we open to them? And it's a process. It's not like we're going to be just, you know, every time hitting a home run. It's going to be sometimes you do get a lot of strikeouts before you finally learn. But that's part. We just start to really appreciate that. Appreciate it. Okay, because you learned a lot by doing that, and thank you for sharing that, because that all, you know, it helps amplify that learning for all of us.
And I think so. After you spoke, I was like, oh, if listening to my body, if it's contracting, that's a
right.
Really good signal.
Exactly. Yeah, I think the body is such a. It's like we're so oriented to our minds and ideas. But the body kind of doesn't lie too much. You know, it's like the body contracts. That's a great time to like, oh, what's going on here? I think mindfulness sometimes, my approach for how to be mindful in our day isn't to go do that super slow mindfulness we learn on retreats. Like, okay, stepping, washing, you know, because life is going so quickly. What we can notice is when we get that contraction, it's almost like a little bell that says, okay, contraction, practice time. and you turn toward that. You say, okay, well, let me notice that sensation. Let me notice the mind state, just like you did. What's the story I'm spinning? You know, how do I need to navigate this world? You know, maybe sometimes you need to advocate for yourself, or sometimes go to a different restaurant. I mean, there's all these different choices. But the contraction tells us, pay attention. And in that way, our meditation practice and our daily life really start to integrate in a beautiful way.
Thank you.
Thank you for sharing that. All right, anyone else like to ask or share anything? Okay, Ellen, go ahead.
Hey, Tim, I just wanted to say I super appreciated the story about you realizing you were having this kind of reaction for the planning the vacation with your family, and then finally asking them like how do they feel. I think that's just it was very touching and connected. In particular, you know, I do, you know, in this practice, we just get to learn, we get to see so much about ourselves. And often, like, we know the experience coming up, we know a little bit about our triggers, we know how it's processing, but we don't, like, we don't see that full picture. And like, just be having them like show the shadow to you. I was just really touched by that story. And it's something I'm looking forward, you know, I have something kind of similar. So really looking forward to practicing that.
Yeah. Thank you, Alan, for sharing that. Yeah, that story I shared, it's interesting because sometimes you can get the feedback and you go into that sense of guilt or that sense of shame or remorse and kind of contract around that. And yeah, you know, I'm sure there was some of that, but it was much more what transformed the action was just the clarity, like, oh, I'm causing harm here. I don't want to cause harm. It's kind of that opening my eyes and actually perceiving that harm. And we often get this kind of loop of self-shame and, okay, self-recrimination and all that kind of stuff tends to, you know, contract us. It's like, okay, so sometimes we honor that's arising, but we also don't listen to those voices, you know, that contraction of self around shame. It's like, okay, I'm a human, I have my conditioning, how can I meet this in a more clear way, a more open-hearted way in the future? Yeah, so that's, thank you for sharing that.
Thanks,
right, anyone else? Yes, do you mind coming up? And then we'll do Susan after this.
Thank you. So my question is, when you are essentially understanding where one's perception is or one's perspective, and you're trying to give that person feedback, and they're not understanding your perspective back, and they're putting up walls or shutting you down, how do you, I guess, if you can, like, open up that conversation, how can you listen to me, how I'm feeling, how that can that be reciprocated to the other person, so that I'm just, you know, blocking you, aka maybe dealing with a very difficult person. You're trying to empathize with them, understand their perspective, and you're trying to share that perspective, but they're just not, they're not getting it, they're not there yet.
Yeah, so you're trying to, like, articulate what you think they're feeling, or you're trying to get your own kind of point across, or both?
Yeah. I'll say both, yeah.
Is this a close friend or something, or a worker?
Work.
Yeah, work, okay. Because, you know, there's different, you know, kind of rules in different relationships, right? There's the work relationship, there's the peers, there's the boss, there's the supervisor, there's the people underneath, there's all those kind of things. Interpersonal, there's this whole other dynamic. And it's, you know, part of it, you know, when teacher talked about, whenever he talked about truth, you would often hear that, you know, afterwards in the parking lot, a couple will go and tell each other their truth about them. Let me tell you what's wrong with you. And kind of missing the point of that. So, so part of it is just that, you know, there's lots of other skill sets, you know, for beyond just dharmic perspective. Like dharma kind of is like almost behind the scenes, looking at the sense of identification, the sense of how we kind of misperceive permanence or self and all those elements. But there's still like just, okay, how do you actually have a difficult conversation? How do you actually say, okay, can I, you know, some key things like ask permission. Can I have something I want to talk to you about? Can we set a time up instead of just ambushing them when they're not ready? So they kind of know that, okay, there's something to talk about. And you can, and, you know, there's a sense of owning your own experience that, you know, I feel frustrated or hurt by that. You know, this is just all this outside in the normal Dharma realm, but it's also good best practices, as it will. And as you're doing that, you know, see if you can notice, what I like to do is, especially if I have a charged, you know, conversation, I like to practice with it kind of beforehand. So what I do is I meditate and I kind of imagine I'm about to give that conversation. And you're going to feel all the emotions come up, you're going to feel all the body sensations. I just try to hang out there. I try to open to that, just as we've talked about a couple of times tonight. What all is here? You're not going into the story too much, but really moment by moment. Often when I do that, I start to realize, okay, there's these deeper beliefs that I didn't realize were there. That's maybe the thing I'm upset about. This is actually really what, you know, I'm angry, but maybe I'm feeling hurt. I'm not feeling seen, for example. The more clarity I can get from my own side of it, then I can be more clear. I may not necessarily tell my boss or my coworker, I just don't feel like you see me, you know, it just triggers that deep thing as me, for me being a child. I don't necessarily say that, but I might say that, you know, I like to have more acknowledgement for my work, that kind of a thing. So you kind of adjust it to what's appropriate in that situation. So it's a tricky, it's really interface. And the big thing is just to practice with it. Practice, be present while you're going through the experience. And the more you do that, you start to find you become clearer on it. I can't give you like, okay, this is the magic thing to say. Say this and it's going to be golden for you. It's an alive process. Yeah.
I appreciate the Dharma perspective on that. Yeah. So thank you so much.
You're welcome. All right. Susan, do you still have your question? It looks like you're still muted. We can't quite hear you, Susan. Let's see. Yeah, we can't hear you. I don't know why. It doesn't look like you're muted from our side. Maybe mute yourself and unmute yourself. Sometimes that has to do with the Zoom mic. Yeah, I still can't hear you. Okay. Time out. All right. Sorry about that, Susan. You could put a chat in if you want. I can maybe answer it that way. All right, anyone else? We have maybe time for one more. Back there? Oh, sorry, I couldn't quite see you.
Okay, so I have two kids. And my daughter and my son like to fight a lot, like to hurt each other, like emotionally. I think that's normal, but it drives me nuts. The other night, I actually was able to, my daughter, I asked her to apologize to her brother. I don't know what she did. Mm-hmm. She kind of froze up and she went downstairs. I ran downstairs, and after a little while, I grumped around a little bit, and I went down, and I talked to her, and I actually just held her for a little bit, and I just thought about it, and for a moment, I was able to gain a little bit of clarity, and I said, you know what, I see when you don't like when you make mistakes, and you don't like when you're when you've done something wrong, and you've and I see that you're hurt, you feel hurt when you do that, and you seize up, and you don't deserve to feel like that. And I got that right. And she kind of melted in my arms. And then today, she was, I don't know, I was asking I was working with my kids and building a playhouse with them. And I was giving her all sorts of kind of fun tasks. She's a little bit older. And then I was having my son hold nails for me so I could pound them in. And she said, oh, is that all he's able to do? And she says it so you can hear it. And then I just like, I don't, and then I kind of exploded. And I don't know how to traverse those. I don't know if this is, I'm not actually asking for like parenting advice, because this happens to me at work too. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know how to traverse that terrain, yeah, where you get it right for a minute and then you just like, you never get it right for another week or two.
Yeah, sometimes it can feel like that, for sure. It's actually similar to the last question is when I, as a parent, I would often notice, okay, I would really want to make a big practice before I said anything or did anything, is just to notice what's really arising in myself, and in a really deep, honest way. Because as your parent, you know, you got your own parents telling you, you know, they're kind of coming through consciously or unconsciously. There's all these patterns, especially when there's that tightness, that sense of this is making me crazy. That's a good thing to practice with and start to notice it. And, you know, so there's all the skillful things to do around it, all the ways to, you know, skillful parenting techniques, and sometimes those work. But it's this inner relationship, I think, is so important to really know your own conditioning, basically. And as a parent, I mean, unfortunately, your conditioning is just, it's always being shown, you know, and at every developmental age, you have a new conditioning hitting you. Like, oh, I thought I was done with this. Oh, now it's teenagers. Oh, you know, and then you have to, it's like you're really kind of reparenting yourself as you go through it. So that's been some really helpful for me, is just to really own my own experience. You know, luckily my wife and I, I could talk about it. She could give me feedback about it, have conversations without the kids around. And, you know, see, and just realize it's a really an alive process, that you try something and you're really listening to see how it's landing, how it's being received. Okay, it's being received. And realize it's a moving picture. The same process next time, they might get really shut down by it or angry. But that's the big thing, is like, know yourself, know your own internal parenting, your own, you know, child stuff, all those things. So you just becomes more and more conscious.
Thank you, and I liked your story about your conversation, or about your dealings with your children, and that's kind of what brought this up, and I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yep, thank you for asking that. Okay, so we have a couple announcements, and Susan, I'm sorry we couldn't hear your question. Good to see you again.
Hey, Tim, sorry. I think we were able to troubleshoot it if we want to try again, but sure. It's up to you if there's...
Sure, yeah, let's go real quick, and then we can... Yeah, go ahead.
Hi, Tim. Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Okay. I turned off my Bluetooth. Thank you for your talk. I really appreciate it. And I'll just cut right to, I wanted to ask you about the word loading. And it was kind of funny. Yeah, I just want to check my understanding of it. I'm a little tired. And it seemed like it was related to this total self identity that arises. It wasn't a positive identity, which we can cultivate, but it sounded like it was just this negative, self-constricted, greedy, you know, self that comes in. Or, and I thought it was, if that's what it was, I thought it was a little humorous to see it that way. But I just wanted to check it out with you, how you're using it.
Sure. I think when I'm using that, it's like, yeah, that loading of the sense of self. And really, it's, I would kind of not think of it as something negative, only if it's unconscious. You know, the unconsciousness of it, that's where the issue is. Let's make it a really kind of a obvious example. Let's say I am a firefighter. Okay, so when I'm going to do the role of firefighting, let's say that's the identity that I'm forming into, I put on my bunker gear, I put on my helmet, you know, I'm all have my fire protection and I go fight the fire. But if I wear that when I go to out to dinner, if I go to, you know, to the beach, and I just keep wearing that layer of clothing, it's not so helpful, right? So I've loaded myself onto that. There's a functionality of these roles I load on. Okay, there's a way I load up as a father, as a spouse, as a teacher. But if I take it as being, that's who I am, that's where the problem is. That's where the suffering is. But if I see, okay, I'm just adding it as a, this is a functionality. I need to, you know, I can't just be completely amorphous and empty. You know, sometimes you have to form into the self for the relative world to function.
Oh, but got it. Thank you.
You don't believe in it in the same way. You know that.
That's very helpful. Yeah. Very helpful. Thank you.
You're welcome, Susan. All right, Kaba, do you want to jump up here and?